Good evening and welcome to the Return to Flight Task Group's post-final public meeting news conference. We apologize for getting a late start. It's been a very busy day for the task group, very busy weekend for the task group. To my immediate left is task group's co-chairman, Richard Covey. To his left is the task group's operations panel lead, Mr. Joe Cuzzopoli. And to his left is the task group's operations panel lead, Colonel Jim Adamson. Dr. Dan Crippen, as most of you know, had another meeting and actually had to leave the public meeting a little early, so he's not with us this evening. We'll have opening statements from each, I believe, of our panel members, and then we'll take questions. One administrative note: at the end of the briefing, we'll roll some B-roll from today's public meeting.
Dave? Thank you, Dave. And just clarification: he introduced both these guys as ops panel leads, and it's really a technical panel for Joe. I think everybody
that's
knew
okay.
That.
Okay, then I won't have to answer any questions.
Well, see, on behalf of General Stafford, who was unable to participate in our meetings today, except for briefly by telecon earlier today, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to come and talk to you one more time. As we discussed earlier today, and we have over time, I'd like to reiterate that the Return to Flight Task Group was chartered by a NASA administrator to perform an independent assessment of the agency's actions to implement the recommendations of the CAVE, specifically the 15 that were identified as Return to Flight. Very specific charter. We also are afforded the opportunity to make observations within our charter, make observations as they apply to operational readiness and safety. We are to report to the administrator through interim and a final report. And so with our activities today, we're getting closer to that final report. Task group is chartered as an advisory body only under a Federal Advisory Committee Act. So we provide advice to the administrator. And administrator, along with the rest of NASCO, will take that advice and use it in the context of everything else that they are doing and the other information available to determine the readiness of flight for STS-114. We will not make a specific determination on whether it's time to return to flight. Okay, that wasn't our charter. We're supposed to assess those 15 recommendations, which are only part of the actions that NASA has taken to get ready to fly. Over the past 2 years, the task group has conducted extensive fact-finding. When we started this, the group anticipated a 6 to 9 month time period. That was what most of us signed up for. So the fact that we're on our 24th month now says that clearly the commitment of time by the task group members has been more than they had anticipated. But during that time period, we have visited facilities, we've reviewed documentations, we've interviewed individuals, received many briefings from NASA. We've attended NASA simulations, meetings, their reviews. And as I've said earlier, we periodically have reported our findings to NASA and the public, both in a written form and then through our public meetings and ability to conduct press conferences. Today, the task group completed completed the assessment of the CAVE's 15 return flight recommendations. In addition, previously we had completed our assessment of Space Shuttle Program Action 3, having to do with using the space station for safe haven and a potential launch on need rescue. During this time and in preparing to get ready for flight and addressing the CAVE recommendations, the efforts undertaken by the agency have been extraordinary and outstanding. And I know from our reports and from the things you've heard from NASA themselves, you know how much work has gone in to the return to flight effort over the last 2 years, particularly as it's applied to these 15 recommendations made by the CAVE. Today, We addressed the three CABE recommendations that probably, and I won't say probably, that were the most technically demanding, challenging that were put forth. The three that related to external tank debris, orbiter hardening, and thermal protection system inspection and repair. We've known since the data CABE report came out, even before, that those were going to be very high standards of their intent. The reason it's taken us 24 months to complete our assessment is because the agency has been working very diligently and hard in those particular areas, and the data that will support return to flight and support our assessments has continued to become available, even through the end of last week with the design verification review. So it was appropriate for us to wait till we had the best data that we could. Faced with the pending flight readiness review on schedule for Wednesday and Thursday, we chose to have our final public meeting today in order to be able to complete our assessments and deliver our assessments to the administrator before the flight readiness review. And we'll do that tomorrow. We have a scheduled meeting with him, and we will deliver those assessments at that time. That way it's timely to a degree for him to be able to use the advice we provide through our assessments in his overall determination, looking at where the program wants to go of readiness to fly. It's also worth noting that many of the activities that we were had delayed to our assessments till today have ongoing work, ongoing beyond STS 114, certainly ongoing beyond today, even before STS 114, and we discussed that in our public meeting. But the real key is the continued effort by the agency to address the concerns that were identified in the CABE recommendations in an appropriate manner relative to the way that the program is designed to go forward, but to not stop, but to continue their efforts toward meeting the intent of the CABE recommendations and go beyond what they've done so far. Our intent, the way that we'll report to the administrator is with an executive summary tomorrow, and our intent is that that would be made available publicly sometime in the afternoon tomorrow. So that's our intent. We hope to be able to do that. And then in the meantime, we're going to continue to finish writing our final report, and we'll publish that as soon as we can when it's completed. And we'll first publish it electronically and then follow up with the ability to get a hard copy report out at some time in the near future. With that, I'm going to let Joe and Jim talk about the specific CABE recommendations that we addressed today and the disposition of those. Joe?
Okay, thank you, Dick. Appreciate it very much. It was a long, hard job for the agency to come up with the final recommendations that they're working on. Again, it being from the program back in the 1978 to 80 time period, a lot of this activity was not done, and it was not done because we didn't expect to be flying in the environment that is currently being, that the vehicle is flying in. So they had to start over. They basically had to start over as far as understanding that environment. And the two serious problems, the fact that we had to eliminate or try to reduce the debris from the external tank, was a big challenge. The fellows and the ladies at MSHU took it upon themselves to take a step higher than the recommendations that came out of the CABE, and looked at all the debris, possible debris that came off. And as you heard today, foam was the majority of the first time period of working on that area. Ice, we started, NASA started working on ice maybe about 2-3 months ago. And it took a while, and they're still working on trying to reduce the, get all the data and understand all the data on the ice. But as we are today, the foam is understood that as far as the debris that's coming off, that they have minimized and reduced the amount of foam that can possibly come off the tank and affect the orbiter. So foam is characterized pretty good, both for the RCC and the TOM. The ice story is still coming together, but again, by analysis, the ice has pretty much cleared everything on the orbiter, specifically the RCC, and on the tiles, as they're getting very close to putting that also to bed. The ET umbilical ice issue is still an open issue, and I think what's going to happen there is NASA is going to recommend that to look at that area as far as forming ice during the filling of the tanks. They'll continue looking at that, and if any ice forms, significant ice forms in that area, they'll probably have to do something else. But right now, we think that that's basically the plan going forward, is to look at, as well as finish up the little bit of the analysis they got on ice on the tiles. Now, as far as the orbiter hardening, we have fixed, they have fixed four areas, and there is one more area that looks like down the road they will work on, and that's around the landing gear doors, main landing gear doors. They will probably have to replace somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 tiles in that area. They're called Tuffy tiles. They're better than the LI-2200 that is on there at this current time. And then the other areas that they have to pay attention to, it's after we, after they get in the air and fly, they're going to have to look at the areas around the external tank doors and see if they get any significant hits regarding either ice or foam in that area. As you know, they had a total of 15,000 hits on the orbiter over the period of 100 and some flights, some of them ice and some of them foam. Exactly how many are ice, how many foam, they don't know. They don't have all the data for all the flights in that area. So in final conclusion, on these two recommendations that our tech panel looked at, we went through about, I would say, somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 meetings to review all the data that NASA has presented, and found that they have a sound plan to go forward, finish up their analysis, and get ready for the FRR, which is currently scheduled for Wednesday of this week, and hopefully resolve those open issues and get to a point of launching sometime mid-July. So, in conclusion, I think they've done one great job.
The operations panel concluded its assessments today and presented the last of the six CABE recommendation that it had lead on, and that's in addition to the SSP3 raise the bar activity that we discussed last time we met. And I'm sure that most of the familiar faces in this room, and I'm pretty sure that the ones on the line that aren't in this room have been following our activities, so you know which ones I'm talking about. So I won't go back and cover all those again. But the one we closed today was 6.4-1, which was the CABE recommendation for return to flight that related to inspection and repair of the TPS. This recommendation consisted really of four parts, inspection and repair for missions to the International Space Station and missions not to the International Space Station. Since NASA adopted a strategy, at least in the beginning, early flights here, return to flight, of going to International Space Station, and does not currently have plans to go for other missions, We did not address the inspection and repair capability to non-ISS missions. That's something that NASA will have to address later if they have a mission that doesn't go to the International Space Station. And for the long haul, CABE, I think, intended that they would ultimately consider inspection and repair capabilities for a totally autonomous mission. The intent of the CABE with respect to inspection and repair was very complicated in this case because it is not totally independent of the other capabilities when you consider all of these in a risk reduction matrix. In other words, if you can solve the problem of debris liberation or harden the orbiter sufficiently, then you don't have to worry quite as much about repair capability. But if you've got if there's some probability that there's going to be some debris liberated and you got to worry about some damage to the orbiter, then it turns up the temperature a little bit on how you feel about what your repair capabilities are. So while we tried to consider these CABE recommendations individually and come up with an assessment individually of whether or not they met the intent, they really had interdependencies that we had to think about. And 641 had a lot of interdependencies because when you consider all of the other recommendation with respect to imagery, photography, observations, sensor systems and the wing leading edges, they all affect how well you can see damage and characterize it. And then if you consider the debris environment and the orbiter hardening issues that the Joe just talked about, it starts to characterize the environment that you're working in with respect to repairing damage. And then, of course, the raise the bar activity was safe haven, and in all cases we wanted to be sure that we had repair options available so that we wouldn't have to fail down to a safe haven situation, because that's not a good option either. So we tried to keep these all within the risk reduction matrix that NASA had defined in its return to flight plan as their strategy for reducing risk. And we wanted to see, since none of these are deterministic, none of these solutions are deterministic, they all involve probabilities and uncertainties, we tried in the end to try to weigh some of these against each other. And what we found with respect to 641 is, as far as inspection is concerned, NASA exceeded what we thought was the intent of CABE. They went above and beyond the capability that we think that that was intended. They've got imagery and sensors and the OBSS. They've got the pitch maneuver on approach to the International Space Station. They have the capability of docking with the space station. They've got so much data that we were a little bit concerned that they have an integrated plan to deal with the data in a decision-making process, and so we set up a sub-panel for vehicle integration and sort of graded them on that. So with respect to inspection on 641, the operations team found that NASA not only met but exceeded what we felt was the intent of CABE.